I have some exciting news for those of you who wish that you could be nearer to Hillsdale College. Now, you can be a part of Hillsdale, no matter where you are in the world. In addition to their free online courses, Hillsdale College has created something new, the Hillsdale College Podcast Network. It allows you to learn even more from Hillsdale anywhere at any time. And on the Hillsdale College Podcast Network, you'll hear podcasts that feature conversations with Hillsdale College faculty, staff, friends, alumni, as well as visiting speakers and authors discussing everything from philosophy to theology to history, economics, politics, and current events. Listen to hundreds of episodes on the network, from the Hillsdale Dialogues to the radio-free Hillsdale Hour to the Larry Arnn Show, all for free. Get informed and entertained at dana4hillsdale.com. That's dana4hillsdale.com, and learn more about their free online courses and the new Hillsdale College Podcast Network. That's dana4hillsdale.com. Hillsdale College, developing minds, changing hearts.
President, you said at the beginning that the debt ceiling was not negotiable. Isn't that what you've just done here? Isn't that
you guys, look, we're not negotiating the debt ceiling. Here's the deal. They passed the debt ceiling, and they said they'd only do it on condition that it have all these cuts in it. I said, I'm not going to do that. You pass the debt ceiling, period. I'll negotiate with you on the cuts, what you say, what's going to happen, what the budget's going to look like. That's what we are negotiating in order to get to them deciding that they're going to go along with a new debt ceiling, meaning that it's not attached. So something totally different attached than was attached before. So if you want to try to make it look like I made some compromise in the debt ceiling, I didn't. I made a compromise on the budget.
That's what they wanted, is you to make a compromise on the budget, and that's what you've done, even though you haven't gone as far as they wanted. Isn't that right?
Sure, yeah. Well, can you think of an alternative?
Yeah. I can think of several alternatives, a lot of them, in fact. And as I imagined, I imagine you also can think of some alternatives with all of this. I think it's going to go through. Hakeem Jeffries is already telling his party. He's already getting people ready to go to vote for this. So we're going to dive into just the latest with it, because the vote's expected today. So welcome to the program. You're lovable curmudgeon. I still am. This Wednesday, although it feels like a Tuesday because yesterday felt like our Monday. We're going to have coming up later, Chip Roy is going to join us. We're going to talk to him a little bit about this, because Thomas Massey went to push for debate on this. So he passed to get this out of committee. So yesterday, all the drama was in the committee. The committee meeting on this to get it out of committee, get it onto the floor, and go from there. And so that's where a significant portion of the drama, that's where all of that was. And we're going to talk about that. We're going to get into all of it, in fact. As always, welcome. Listen coast to coast. Stream the radio program. If you're not listening terrestrially, you can also watch the simulcast of the program on YouTube, Facebook, Channel 347, DirecTV. All right, so this bill, some things about this bill that's going through. So yesterday, as I just explained, the drama all was taking place in the committee. They get it out of committee. They're taking it to the floor. Thomas Massey wanted to, and I was reading about this, he's pushing, and I get what he's saying. He thinks that, you know, it's better to have Democrats making a public spectacle of themselves defending this. I get it. But at the same time, I'm still, because yes, everyone can yell about it, and voting for it to move out of committee, going to the floor for debate, isn't a vote of endorsement or support for the bill. These are all procedural things. This is all procedural stuff. And so I think it was, because I can't imagine he would vote for this and support it. Although Marjorie Taylor Greene, as Lorraine noted with The Hill, says that she's inclined to support it, but she wants to secure some caveats there for her. Now, one of the things that Matt Gaetz had said was passing a debt deal, if McCarthy doesn't have a majority, would trigger an immediate motion to oust McCarthy. I actually don't see that happening. I don't see it happening. And there's a reason why. So let me explain some of the theater of this. Because I don't like the bill. I think it's garbage. But remember how I was saying that some of the previous pieces of legislation, whether it's the not really Inflation Reduction Act, or whether it's some of the budget stuff prior, that was the look at it like those. That was the legislation that had the items that needed to be funded, and this is the mechanism by which to fund them. So you're negotiating on items that have already been passed in a budget by Congress, if that makes sense. So these are budgetary items that Congress had already debated on requiring funding, and they passed it. So you're not necessarily arguing about the budget criteria for these things. You're arguing over how much debt. I mean, literally, it's a debt ceiling negotiation. You're arguing as, you know, how much debt the United States is allowed to have at a particular time. Now, this right here is why I think Gaetz's remark is theater. And it's why the Freedom Caucus is doing what the Freedom Caucus needs to do. Because, and I would imagine, looking at this strictly as tactics for the overall strategy, that Kevin McCarthy needs the House Freedom Caucus to do what it is that they do, because it helps to protect conservative reputations. Now, there is some truth to the premise that there is only so much McCarthy can do, yet I still think that there are more concessions you can win if you're going to have any kind of discussion over a debt ceiling, i.e., just because it is a negotiation on the debt ceiling regarding, as we just said, budgetary items that Congress has passed, doesn't necessarily mean that this is, there's no opportunity to stick in some withholding and make some demands on other items in, as a concession from them. So that's, and as Kane noted, who's going to be in the House? Who's going to be the House majority in 2 years? So you have the House Freedom Caucus members. They are the ones who are very vociferously opposing this. And the objections that they are raising are legitimate objections. And I think that, you know, when they were bringing up, for instance, the RAINS Act, etc., and, you know, all of that, I completely get it. I think that that makes perfect sense. And I'm just explaining to you, I mean, you guys know I don't like any of this. I don't like the other things that were passed prior. But they kind of, if you look at it like this, there were two choices, sort of. I have an asterisk here. Because you're going into an election year. Democrats wanted to essentially forego this and push it all the way back to an election year. They're demanding, oh, these year, you know, 1 year concession here. I don't think there should be any 1 year concession. I think if you're gonna you got to do what you're gonna do. They're allowing for a 1 year concession because that helps them more than it hurts them. They get to use it as a get out the vote apparatus with their base. But here's, I mean, kind of the two paths that you're looking at if you're in the House. And I disagree with some of the analyses that there have been some concessions made by Democrats. I just don't think there have been enough to even say that, if I'm being honest. But if you wanted to politically humiliate the opposing party and continue to hammer the fact that Republicans have been the only people coming to the table and negotiating, then that might, maybe the people who are saying that this bill does no wrong, maybe that's a win for them. But, you know, you could also say, and this is one of the things that I think Massey was alluding to, if you just jettison the entire bill altogether, then there's the concern that Republicans will wear the yoke. They will be yoked with it will be a default, and the consequences of it, which I'm actually okay with. But I also am not worried about an elected seat, but I'm okay with it. Yes, Kane.
Is there a time where Republicans don't get blamed?
No.
This is what, that's what I'm
saying.
They
get blamed for everything.
Exactly.
They could find a cure for all diseases and they would still be blamed.
Exactly. So it literally doesn't matter where the blame falls on. I wish Republicans would grow a spine and see that.
Mm-hmm. Oh, I completely agree. I totally agree. And there isn't, what is it? I think it's $4 trillion. If you want to say that it's a cap, I don't know. Maybe it's a cap.
Could be six.
Could be, yeah. Nobody, yeah. Question, yeah. This is Dan Bishop. He was, Congressman Bishop was talking about this. And this is the question he was asking.
People said, actually, Kevin McCarthy said the Democrats didn't get anything in this bill. Who do you think wanted the maximum length extension of the debt ceiling and to make it undefined so nobody can pin it down? It may be $6 trillion. I was thinking
maybe $6 trillion. We're gonna talk to Congressman Chip Roy, audio soundbite 14. He made a really good point, a very, very fiery speech before press yesterday. Listen to what he had to say here.
My colleagues, be very clear, not one Republican should vote for this deal. It is a bad deal. No one sent us here to borrow an additional $4 trillion to get absolutely nothing in return. But at best, if I'm being really generous, a spending freeze for a couple of years. That's it. That's about what you get. And frankly, you're going to make things worse. And my Democratic colleagues know it. That's why they're supporting it. Mm-hmm. That's why they're going around gleeful. Look, there's a reason our Democrat colleagues support this. There's a reason that Mitt Romney supports this.
There's the poison pill right there. Well, you know, Mitt Romney likes it, but he's not wrong. But there's, you have Hakeem Jeffries now. He's the House Minority Leader. He endorsed the deal. He's endorsed it. He's pushing, reluctantly, he's pushing his caucus to support it. And the House Freedom Caucus is, very, very, as you just heard Congressman Chip Roy, pushing very, very much pushing hard against it. And they can because, it is, a lot of this is theater. I mean, I was looking at the numbers. So you have, 53 members of the Freedom Caucus. And if McCarthy didn't have the Freedom Caucus, you have about 220 House Republicans. So if you get 110 plus, then you don't need the 53. And McCarthy knows it. And all Jeffries has to do, he's got 215 members. If he can't get 60 to support it, then there's the problem. I almost would want, honestly, sidebar. Shh. This is just between all us. We're all friends. This is when I'd be like, I'd send, some of my mole Republicans out there to like whip against it for Democrats so that they couldn't get the votes up against it. That would be amazing, actually. I would like that. Let's do that. I hope that happens. So we got a lot to hit. We got to talk about some 2024 stuff because what on earth? I don't know if you guys saw some of what was going down on social media last night, but we got to have a little discussion about why we have one candidate who's literally defending Andrew Cuomo and almost like trying to I know what's happening. We also have some analysis on Ken Paxton, A.G. Paxton, this witch hunt, and then the manner in which they're doing this, because this isn't just about Texas. It could really happen in your state. We also have wokery, Chick-fil-A. Here's a question to think about, because this is a little different than the Target and the Kohl's. Do conservatives risk going too far with Chick-fil-A? Think about this. You're turning on essentially what was considered a conservative avatar. Well, we're going to have that discussion and more here. Folks, your financial freedom is at stake when the government thrives on creating unrelenting inflation and astronomical debt, crippling interest rates, and market turmoil that we haven't seen in decades. And now you have an administration that wants to tax everything that you have to fund runaway entitlement spending. You should empower yourself with opportunity and the freedom to pursue success and to keep the fruits of your hard work. And if you want to protect your future, you should call a precious metals dealer that I trust, American Hartford Gold. They can show you how to protect your savings and retirement accounts by diversifying your portfolio with physical gold and silver. And all it takes to get started is a short phone call. And American Hartford Gold can have physical gold and silver delivered right to your door or inside your IRA or 401k. They make it easy. American Hartford Gold is the highest rated firm in the country with an A+ rating from the Better Business Bureau and thousands of satisfied clients. Call today and they'll give you up to $5,000 of free silver on your first qualifying order. Call American Hartford Gold today at 866-887-1188. That's 866-887-1188 or text Dana to 998899. That's 866-887-1188. 887-1188 or text Dana to 998899.
And now, all of the news you would probably miss. It's time for Dana's Quick Five.
So apparently, of all the people to put on the World Health Organization Executive Board, they decide that North Korea is the acceptable country to place as a designated entity on the executive board of the 76th World Health Assembly Organization. Yes, the regime that literally jailed a toddler because their parents had a Bible. That's an actual story. Jailed a straight-up toddler. North Korea. Or, I'm sorry, the Democratic People's Republic of North Korea. So stupid. Yeah, there, as if you needed any other evidence that that's a joke of an organization. There you go. A New York City lawyer admits to using ChatGPT for research in a case where a client sued an airline over a knee injury, and it was revealed that the AI chatbot cited cases that it had just made up. Roberto Mata says he was injured by a metal serving cart on a flight. His lawyer, Stephen Schwartz, submitted a 10-page brief featuring all of these relevant court decisions, but six of the cases were entirely made up by the chatbot, the AI chatbot. Wow. I mean, I wonder, or did he just ask Sidney Powell? I don't know. Whoa, anyways, move on. Who said that? Kane, shame on you. It was you. A giant grocery chain is fighting to stay alive, essentially, in San Francisco. Whole Foods, they closed in San Francisco. They were not even open a year because of safety concerns. And now, because they have 165 supermarkets, Washington, D.C., Maryland, Virginia, Delaware, they're trying to keep stores open in cities where crime is on the rise. How sad is that? Stay with us. We got a lot more in store. When you see judicial rot running rampant and American companies embracing insanity and wokery, you got to fight back, starting with the way that we spend our money. So for years, big mobile companies have dumped millions into leftist causes, and we just kind of took it because another option didn't exist. Well, now one does. Patriot Mobile is America's only Christian conservative wireless provider, and they offer dependable nationwide coverage on all three major networks, so you get the best possible service in your area without the woke propaganda. And when you switch to Patriot Mobile, you support free speech and religious freedom, the sanctity of life, Second Amendment, and our military veterans and first responders. Their 100% U.S.-based customer service team makes switching easy. Visit patriotmobile.com/Dana or call them at 878-PATRIOT and get free activation today with offer code Dana. Ask about their coverage guarantee as well. patriotmobile.com/Dana or call 878-PATRIOT. PatriotMobile.com/Dana or call 878-PATRIOT.
It turns out elections have consequences. Is the debt ceiling actually a farce? What sacrifices did each side give up in their agreement? What did Republicans actually agree upon with their slim majority? Are they making America great again or making America solvent again? Check out the Watchdog on Wall Street podcast on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcast.
YouTube, Facebook, or DirecTV. If you're looking for the number one afternoon host in the country, you've found her. Download the podcast every day to catch up. The Dana Show.
We now see Washington has now cooked up their latest, quote, debt deal. And I can tell you this, our nation was careening towards bankruptcy before the debt deal, and it will still be careening towards bankruptcy after this debt deal. This is greenlighting $4 trillion in new debt in less than 2 years. It took us almost 200 years to get to $4 trillion in debt in the first place. It locks in inflated COVID level era levels of spending, and it keeps 98% of the 87,000 new IRS agents that Joe Biden instituted. This is not going to solve our nation's fiscal problems. I can tell you, in Florida, we run budget surpluses.
You know, in Texas, we have a budget surplus, too, although they're trying to break that with the open border. Welcome back to the program. Dana Loesch here with you. Bottom of this first hour, this Wednesday, that was Florida Governor Ron DeSantis. He was in Iowa. Yeah, Iowa yesterday. Governor Kim Reynolds, I think, hosted him at an event out there and was speaking to. You can tell the voters really, they love the debt deal. You can just tell. Yeah. You heard that. Those were. Yeah, that's some excitement. I mean, oh, man. You know that Republicans in the Senate got to be looking at this thing coming at them going, oh, my gosh, we got to deal with this before we got to. Yay, us. We have to deal with this now. Oh, we'll keep you updated about that vote and everything else happening with that. Let's talk a little bit primary and then some wokery. We got a bearded fairy godmother over at Disney we got to talk about. I tweeted this and first off, let me play. Where's this audio at? Let me set it up so you can fully understand. So you know that, or maybe you don't. And I wish that I was lying because I don't want this to be true. Trump was saying that Cuomo did a great job with New York and that other states, I'm not making this up. This is like literally verbatim what he has been saying with lockdown. He's been on his Twitter platform saying this with COVID, etc., saying that that Cuomo did better than DeSantis. And I get that it's already a bitter primary. Oh my gosh, do we have to do that though? For real. So there's more. Hold up. He said that he said it on video a couple of times. He said it in a tweet and he hit it again yesterday that Florida had, they had high number of deaths and they shut down. Then he got mad. He was saying that they had the third most deaths of any state. Even Cuomo did better. And then I know.
What?
Don't tell Janice Dean. Oh. And he keeps saying things like this, like, oh, well, New York did better, you know, et cetera, et cetera. I don't know why he didn't stay there and why he relocated entirely to Florida if it did better. Now, look, I know that, you know, he's got a different way of doing campaigning, but oh my gosh, I don't want to see any Republican celebrating Cuomo. Stop it. I want one of his handlers to grab his phone and sit on it. Don't do this because this is what happens. So now you've got Cuomo who is basically like giving an endorsement of this. And he was saying, well, it's great that he tweeted this out. I retweeted it. Let me pull up my tweet. I have like a million things open right now. Bear with me. He tweeted this. He retweeted something from, I guess it was the Trump War Room on Twitter. Oh my gosh. And then he was saying that that he was happy that the truth is coming out. He says, this is what Cuomo tweeted. Quote, Donald Trump tells the truth finally. New York got hit first and worst, but New Yorkers acted responsibly. Florida's policy of denial allowed COVID to spread, and that's why they had a very large second wave. And then, I'm not kidding, and then you have the Trump War Room tweeting. They're tweeting each other now. And then, so this is what the Trump War Room, this was like earlier this morning. They tweeted Cuomo praising Trump. And, well, listen, this is what they tweeted. An actual flashback, this is 23.
Always had a very good dialogue, but the president and I agreed yesterday, look, we're fighting the same war, and this is a war, and we're in the same trench. And I have your back, you have my back,
my gosh,
and we're going to do
you.
Everything we can for the people of the state of New York.
Oh, please.
And the president agreed to that.
I can't even. He tweeted this out because Cuomo was praising Trump, and so the Trump War Room, which is their official like rapid response thing on Twitter, retweeted it and was like praising it. Okay, there are so many other ways to go after a primary than this, and I don't even know if I have words. Why are we doing this? And I just retweeted. I just said, please stop. Please do not do this. Please do not sit here and celebrate. Why is this camp promoting death Cuomo now? Why? It's killing me. Stop.
Who is this Trump?
Yeah, I mean, defending the guy whose policy killed grandparents to try to scorn a primary challenger, I think that's peak primary. And we're not even a week in. Stop. It's like watching your parents fight. Sad. That really hit with Gen X. Gen X was like, just now. Golly. So that doesn't look good. And I don't know how or why, who's telling him to do this. I'm not quite sure. That's bad. Because New York handled it so irresponsibly. So promoting death Cuomo is not the best way to do it. Going after your previous press secretary for simply citing a poll isn't the way to do it either. Now, what gets me about this is back in 2015, McEnany, his press secretary at the time, was like calling him a racist, literally calling him a racist verbatim on CNN when she worked at CNN. And I remember I was one of the people that got really mad about that because I just thought that was beyond to sit here and say that he was a racist. That was in 2015. You know, for all the people that have gotten mad at me for my calling balls and strikes, I've never done that, and nor have a lot of other people. So I jokingly said, wow, wait until he finds out what she was calling him in 2015. Because she was like, yes, he says racist things. He's racist. I mean, it's the video and transcripts are all out there. But a lot of people change their tune pretty quick, I think. And the problem that he is creating for himself is you have people who turned their, I mean, completely did a 180 because, you know, the opportunity to work with an administration, you know, that's attractive to a lot of people. They go and they work with the administration. They do the dirty work of the administration. And then as a reward for that, you blast them because they cite a poll. Really? Like, I think if you're going to go after somebody for what they're saying in 20, but citing a poll, that's not reason to do that. I'm so tired of this meandering, ever-changing bastardization of what loyalty is. Loyalty is not a one-way street. It's not. And there's no such thing as loyalty when it comes to politicians. And this is the only time it's really a one-way street, unless it's a politician talking about loyalty to the people and the authority of their consent that they have given them by way of their vote. That's the only loyalty that matters in politics. I'm so tired of having this like, oh, let's, you know, you got to, that's instead of having a candidate who fights for you, you're supposed to fight for the candidate. That's not how this works. This is not the agreement. But I just thought that was bad. You're not going to get people, good people to work for you if they're worried about you blasting them, if they merely cite a poll. There was nothing wrong with that. So I don't know. I think that it's just not, this is not a good look for him. And I really wish that he had some better people around him advising him. And now you've got Mike Pence who wants to launch his campaign. Sit down. Nobody wants you to run. Nobody wants you to run. Like Chris Christie is, you know, like farting out rumors from New Jersey that he's thinking about running for the... Nobody wants that. Like literally, this is America. No one. Chris Christie, I may run for the White House. Mike Pence may be a very nice gentleman. He's been on the program before. I know Indiana loves him. He was a talk radio host in Indiana. Dude, your time has passed. It's done. You peaked at VP. It's not going to happen. It is not going to happen. It's just not a thing. And I think a lot of people get in there to raise their profile. They want book deals or they're stalking horses, you know, something to that effect, or they're auditioning for a job and maybe a potential administration. So that's why they act very preferential to one candidate over another. But no, nobody wants him in there. Nobody wants him in there. So I wish that 45 would campaign more on what he's done. Like do what your accomplishments. That's what you need to be focusing on. So yeah, Trump, can't make your point, King, because I thought this was a good point.
Well, I don't know why he went from COVID as a hoax, if you remember in the beginning, this was 2020, 2021, to now just praising Democrats.
Yeah.
Who is this guy?
Well, I'll let DeSantis have a word here. This is his what he said in Iowa, audio sum by 20. This was yesterday at one of the stops that he made in Iowa. Listen to this.
Thank you so much. So you talked about changing your tone a little bit with former President Trump. I don't believe you mentioned him here by name tonight, but does this mean you're going to be a bit more aggressive with campaigning against him?
So look, I'm going to respond to attacks. I mean, if you say Cuomo did a better job with COVID than Florida did, first of all, that's not what he used to say. This is like new. Like 6 months ago, he would have never said that, right? He used to say how great Florida was. Hell, his whole family moved to Florida under my governorship. Are you kidding me? So some of this stuff, I think, is look. If someone is saying that, I am gonna counterpunch. I'm gonna fight back on it. I'm gonna focus my fire on Biden. And I think he should do the same. He gives Biden a free pass. I'm focusing on Biden.
I blame this on a lot of the people that he has surrounding him with Trump. Bad, bad, bad advising going on here. So, there's some of that. Kane, just go ahead and say it, Kane. Don't sit here and put it in Slack.
I'm trying to be, you know, courteous. It's his own ego.
This is politics. There's no courtesy in baseball or politics.
His ego seems to be oversizing everything else, and that's a bad look.
I read this piece yesterday. I think I put it in your email prep. Because whether you dislike him or not, and this is how I look at stuff. I mean, I told you guys my preference out of the gate, because a lot of these other cats out there, I know exactly what they're doing and exactly where they are. And I don't work for no pack. I don't work for no politician. Nobody pays my way to nothing. If I want to go and talk to someone and like grill them on things to determine whether or not I like them, you know, I'll do it. But I don't let anybody facilitate me doing anything because I hate most politicians. It's very transactional. But the reason I came out immediately out of the gate was like, well, here's my preference for the primary. It's because I know a lot of these cats out there are not being honest with you. I mean, if I wanted to be an actual ass, I would sit here and name names of people and be like, here's a photo of them at this event. Here's a photo of them at this event. Now, you might want to ask them who actually paid for them to go down there, because some of those instances, it's true. These people don't want to be honest with you. I mean, I don't care whether or not I have, you know, best friendships with these politicians, because that's why I never go to D.C. unless I'm dragged. So I just like, well, this is what. But here's at that same time, though. I want to have the best, strongest, healthiest bench, and I don't want a single person on my side compromising themselves with stupid, unenforced errors. And that's what I feel like this is. I look at it like I want a plan A, I want a plan B, I want a plan C, I want a plan D. I want to have multiple avenues of winning by the time the general comes around. I don't want people making stupid mistakes that compromise their chances. And that's what I feel like he's doing here. Oh, and it's just, I cannot stand when unenforced errors like this are made. Now, oh, except for, you know, like maybe Christie. I'm okay. I'm not a fan. You know, he sent me a Christmas card one year, and I have no idea why. I mean, it was a very nice Christmas card. It was his family, and I'm sure it was a nice thing to do. Is that like the wrong way to react to that stuff? Most normal people would be like, oh, that's so nice. I get it. I'm like, why the hell are you sending this to me? Why do I have this?
Always be skeptical.
The KS7 from Kel-Tec might be short and slim on the outside, but it's long under the hood with its 18.5-inch barrel packed into its bullpup design. It's ready for home defense, backcountry hiking, or anywhere you need a compact 12-gauge shotgun. The KS7 is lightweight with a magazine capacity of 6+1 or 7+1, depending on shell size, easy to handle with rear loading and downward ejection, and standard carry handle that doubles as a sighting solution. Every KS7 produced at Kel-Tec is made in the USA by a team who takes pride in their work and believes in respect, family, and the right to bear arms. Every KS7 comes with a lifetime warranty with proof of purchase as original owner. Defend what matters most to you with the KS7 shotgun available through Kel-Tec. Learn more at KelTecWeapons.com. That's KELTEC Weapons.com. And sign up for the Kel-Tec Insider and get a 15% coupon for your next order of gear and accessories. Secure your world with Kel-Tec. KelTecWeapons.com.
Catch The Dana Show noon to 3 p.m. Eastern on DirecTV Channel 347.
Like sands through the hourglass, so are the days of the United States.
I recognized yesterday I made a post that was hurtful to the Pride community, which includes friends of mine and close family members of mine, and I am truly sorry for that. I just spoke with my teammates and shared with them my actions yesterday. I apologize with them. And as of right now, I'm using the Blue Jays resources to better educate myself, to make better decisions moving forward. The ballpark is for everybody. We include all fans at the ballpark, and we want to welcome everybody. That's all I have to say.
Thank you. That's Blue Jays pitcher Anthony Bass, who apparently they were saying he promoted anti-alphabet campaigns. He was talking about Target and Bud Light, and he like posted one thing on his Instagram stories that was saying Christians stop patronizing companies in the U.S. And that's it. And then they made him, he had to apologize for that. What? It wasn't anti anything. It was talking about stuff that actually was like directing marketing at kids in the kids section, the tucking swimsuits that, who was it? I think Daily Signal had to go out and debunk the AP thing. The AP was saying it was an adult swimsuit, and Daily Signal took a video camera and we're like, no, here's the kids section. Here's the stuff right here. It's on video. I think I have that linked in a piece that is coming out or already came out. So this, he had a statement. I don't think he needed to apologize for anything. But you know what? This is why this stuff keeps happening. I also think it's funny that this is the same guy who lost his mind when he had his wife had to pick up the mess his kids made on United Airlines. And as Kane said, he was like, why couldn't the plane people do it? My wife is pregnant. She doesn't bend. Why couldn't the plane people pick it up? It's like it, when your kids make a mess, I don't care who you are. You pick up the horrible mess that they made. And apparently it was like really bad. But I just, why did he have to apologize? That's so stupid. I wouldn't have been apologizing for anything. Gosh, it's just so dumb. But and this is why, you know, you're going to keep wearing the jerseys and you're going to keep doing this stuff because you cave and you apologize. That's why. I mean, he simply shared something. But that's the thing. I feel like trans activists want the gay community to white knight for them. Because they know that if they conflate it, it makes it harder to harder for, you know, they can't defend some of the stuff they're doing. So they need the community. They need the conflation. Stick with us. Second hour on the way.
It's been more than a month since the re-election announcement. Is President Biden going to hold a campaign event ever?
So I will say this to you, Peter, as you know, we follow the rule of law here. We believe in following the rule of law as it relates. Hold on.
The hell does that even mean? That's not what he asked. He's like, is he gonna hold a campaign event? She's like, well, we follow the rule of law. It's the rule of law. Follow it. That's what we do. That's KJP yesterday talking to Peter Ducey. Welcome back to the program. Dana Lash here with you, top of this second hour on Wednesday. You can listen coast to coast terrestrially. You can stream the program. You can watch the simulcast of the radio program as well. On YouTube, Facebook, DirecTV, Channel 347. And make sure you subscribe to the newsletter, Chapter and Verse, over at Substack. Lots of good stuff up there. Comes out daily. Now, I don't think he's going to hold one. I didn't actually look and see what he had on the calendar today. I know that he basically did nothing yesterday. He came back from Delaware, and that was it. KJP had the presser. That was pretty much it. That's it. You don't have nothing else to deal with. Okay. So he's an ice cream stop. Yes, thank you, Juan. An ice cream stop. He probably did have that. Probably did have that. I want to get into some of the wokery here. Because we have this issue with Chick-fil-A. Have you guys seen this? So I was reading about this yesterday. Chick-fil-A, remember the, I guess, the boycott of Chick-fil-A when everyone wanted to go to Chick-fil-A because it was the, what do they call the protest? This was back in 2012. You had the alphabet community that wanted to boycott Chick-fil-A because they found out that Dan Cathy, the guy who owned it, was Christian. And they were, I guess they thought that you was going to get baptized with a sweet tea. I don't know. I just, you know, who knows what people thought. This Jesus chicken. But anyway, everybody went to Chick-fil-A, right? Everybody loved going to Chick-fil-A. Well, now it comes out that they hired a vice president of diversity, equity, and inclusion, and that this went out, and they've had they have a DEI page. Now, the guys, they hired him back in 2020, but apparently it just now spread. They originally released a statement, Chick-fil-A did, back in 2021 to speak about their company mission with DEI and all of this stuff. And the statement that they had was, quote, "We are better together. One of our core values at Chick-fil-A means when we combine our unique backgrounds and experiences with a culture of belonging, we can strengthen the quality of care we deliver. Chick-fil-A Inc.'s commitment to being better at together means embedding diversity, equity, and inclusion in everything we do." Okay, I have a problem with that. That's not a good thing, because it's equity is not what equality is. And as I've explained before, this is a very Marxist principle. It's critical theory. And at the heart of equity is discrimination, because you have to have discrimination for equity. Equality is against that. So I think it's disappointing to see this, and I don't know why. Yeah, just be about quality. I mean, I have these, you know, Kane notes. I have these questions too. Why can't you just be like, we serve everybody as we always have with quality? The end. All this DEI stuff is branding of the sheep herd. That's what it is. DEI, diversity, equity, inclusion. I mean, I don't know why we keep having to affirm the same stuff over and over again. But then I was thinking about this too, because I mean, this is Chick-fil-A. I mean, this is the entity that I mean, conservatives protested for. And so that statement that I just read to you, that came out in 2021. A lot of people, I guess, really hadn't known that they have this, you know, Marxist DEI statement, and they were doing all of this stuff. And then it came out. Do you remember? And I remember seeing this right when it first came out, and I thought it was performative. I think that some people genuinely have a heart and they want to make this demonstration of treating everyone equally, but sometimes it looks pandering and contrived. And it's this video where is this at? It's a flashback. This flashback video where, which Kathy was it? Who is the Chick-fil-A CEO? He sent out shoe shine packages to store managers to remind them about, you know, contrition and humility, and, you know, to atone for historical participation in slavery. And he was giving this speech, and he got up and was like, started washing the shoes of this other dude on stage. And the other dude on stage did not look humbled. He looked like, wow, this is really, it seemed performative. Listen to this audio soundbite 9 flashback.
I invite folks to put some words to action here. And if we need to find somebody weird that needs to have their shoe shine, we need to just go right on over and shine their shoes. And whether they got tennis shoes on or not, maybe
like
they got sandals
like, this
on.
This is performative.
It really doesn't matter. But there's a time in which we need to have, you know, some personal action here. Maybe we need to give them a hug, too,
brother. And some stock in Chick-fil-A.
But I
got to tell you,
I bought about 1,500 of these.
This kind of goes along with the line. I had a conversation with Max Lucado once, and he was roommates with the pastor at our church. And I always believe in, you know, talking to people privately and going about it, you know, the New Testament way. But I had been, I wrote a piece about it at the time. I was upset because Lucado was getting into some of this DEI stuff when he was making remarks during lockdown in his sermons. And it made me angry. And so I called him up, and, you know, we spoke for a bit. And I said, you know, I realize, you know, we come from different generations and we grew up in very different parts of the country. And I explained to him, you have to realize that I don't know what kind of life you've lived or what you've experienced or what other people have experienced because of your actions. But this is, you know, what you're talking about, what people have to atone for. This is kind of a foreign concept to a lot of people in my generation we didn't pay attention to that because it didn't exist for us. We didn't know differences. We didn't know any of that. It wasn't pushed up on us, and it definitely wasn't weaponized politically and pushed upon us as it is now. And I told him, I said, when you're asking people to assume culpability in something that they had no part in, it creates resentment. And is that not creating a hurdle for other people? And we had a very in-depth conversation. And I get the same feeling watching this stuff. And so I see this, you know, Chick-fil-A made this hire. I do think that this is different than, you know, Bud Light or Target or Kohl's, because they're not, you know, obviously not doing the same thing that they're doing. They're not advertising for the love of all things holy here, you know, tux swimsuits, good heavens. But it is DEI. And DEI is based in Marxist critical theory. I've written about this for over 10 years. That is a theory based on hatred and division. It is antithetical to Christian teaching. DEI is antithetical to Christianity, period, because it teaches you that there are, I mean, it's like the Klan wrote it. It demands that you acknowledge these differences and you live your life accordingly, and that certain people must be given certain things. You have to employ discrimination in order to have equal outcomes. Instead of having a level playing field, everybody gets an opportunity, you might have different outcomes. Different outcomes are not allowed with equity. That's the difference between equity and equality. And it's anti-biblical nonsense. And it kind of shocks me that a company that is so proud about its faith would incorporate something like this as part of their mission statement. And I do think that Chick-fil-A and their CEOs and the Cathy family should absolutely address that. If you're people of faith, I think you should. And I think you have an obligation to, especially since you've made such a public show of it. And I don't think that is in any way a ridiculous demand. Now, to that point, if I was a strategist for Marxist theory, I would want to make my opponents turn on each other. I would want, you know, the Chick-fil-A, for instance, is sort of a avatar brand, if you will, of conservatism, is it not? I mean, isn't that why you had, who is it, Rahm Emanuel, who didn't want a Chick-fil-A in Chicago, saying that their values aren't Chicago values? And I'm like, I guess it's not about gangs and drugs and shooting. I don't know. And you had leaders in New York City say the same thing. In Austin, didn't they try to drive Chick-fil-A out of an airport in Austin? I mean, it's Jesus chicken. That's how they look at it. If I were a strategist for Marxist critical theory, for wokery, I would want conservatives to turn on the brands that they identify as being part of them and other people identify as being part of them. I would want to foster a sense of betrayal, knives out, and I would want them to go at each other's throats. Now, I don't know why Chick-fil-A felt the need to do this. I know that they are a privately owned company, but I do know that their banks and suppliers and everything else, they may not be. And ESG is a very real thing, environmental social governance standard. So even if they are a privately owned company, that still plays into this. And I think that if you make conservatives turn on an avatar of their business, then I think that really exceeds the expectations of the Marxists that I think have created this environment to where, in which, you know, Chick-fil-A feels the need to release a statement like this. So I think that we need to be very careful in how we deal with this. I don't think that this is the same thing as, you know, Bud Light. I don't think it's the same thing as Target. I think it's one thing to sell children's clothes with images that affirm adult sexual practices. And I think it's another thing to have a statement like this. Now, I'm not saying I support this at all. Like I just told you, I thought it was unchristian. I don't know how I can be more harsh in my criticism of it. But I do think that it's entirely different. And I think that we need to take that into account in how we deal with this. And I think that they we owe each other the opportunity here to make that explanation. Just as we level our criticism, I think that they also owe us, because we have stuck up for them so much, an explanation as to why they feel this is the best move forward and how they think that Marxist DEI fits in with Christian principles.
And now, all of the news you would probably miss. It's time for Dana's Quick Five.
Utah's Republican Congressman Chris Stewart plans to resign. He's expected to announce his departure soon, according to the Salt Lake Tribune. He's apparently leaving because his wife has ongoing health issues. They didn't elaborate as to what those issues may be, but it will require a special election. So you could have House Republicans be short the numbers, obviously, that they have right now. So they're going to take a already slim majority and make it a little smaller. So that's going to be, we'll have a special election for that. Also, moving on here, this is why, oh my gosh, I told you yesterday why, but there was another, like, what, people were sick on a cruise ship, then there was another cruise ship that was destroyed by floods while sailing in a storm. Not a fan of doing the cruises. And then the U.S. government, this headline, is going to appear in court over the Ginger Spare Prince Harry's visa application after his drug revelations in the memoir. He, like, wrote in his memoir as he's trying to come to the United States that he was doing drugs, which is a big no-no, because you can be denied entry. And so now the government has to appear in federal court next Tuesday to answer questions about his visa application. The Heritage Foundation is suing the Biden administration to force officials to release the Duke of Sussex's immigration files. They want to know how he got in the U.S., despite the fact that he was bragging all over through his memoir about doing drugs. Just, I don't know. The billionaire Sackler family that owns Purdue Pharma are given immunity from civil lawsuits from opioid victims in exchange for $6 billion to fund and treat addiction. This is an interesting story. They're paying billions in exchange for blanket immunity, is what it is, in Purdue Pharma's role in the opioid crisis. It is the U.S. Court of Appeals. They approved the settlement, Second Circuit, that would result in the family paying about $5.5 to $6 billion as part of this deal to get the broad protection. And it would end bankruptcy proceedings that began in 2019. And then the settlement money will go towards addressing the worsening opioid crisis. So they're buying their way out of it, is what they're doing. Wow. Wow. Can you imagine if you were, there's specialer, I guess. Al Pacino is going to be a dad at age 83. Daily Mail says he's joining the old dad club. I think that's cruel. 83 years old. His girlfriend's 28. She's 8 months pregnant. He's 83. He's not going to see this kid grow into adulthood. I mean, statistically, it's kind of cruel. Is it not cruel? I don't know. Anyway, I guess they're happy about it, but it's weird. I just got to say, it's kind of weird, Kane. It's just odd. Just saying. I don't know. And then the New Yorker has a piece, which we're going to talk about later. The headline, The Rise of Latino White Supremacy. They say that Latinos are potential perpetrators of white supremacy. I guess because they're white adjacent. I don't know. They're white adjacent. That's what the media has been trying to push for the longest time. Coming up, Congressman Chip Roy from the state of Texas joins us on that debt ceiling bill. Don't miss.
Between Twitter, Facebook, or any of your social media, there's a lot of information out there. That's why your lovable curmudgeon is here to help you make sense of it all. Live or on demand, The Dana Show.
It's done without those 35 votes.
Oh, we'll get it done overwhelmingly. Look, people have different opinions. Before this, I had 17 Republicans who have never voted for a debt ceiling, period. To govern is not easy, but I don't want to be on the wrong side of history. Every single one of those members who vote no will miss the opportunity to vote for the largest cut in American history.
Can you get it done without them?
Oh, yeah, we'll get it done without them.
You'll get enough Democrats to come on board?
Look, the president came to an agreement. I think from that point is that we found every time you've ever had two agreements made like that, both sides come together, and what happens as one of the other side comes on.
I think it's just a little bit maybe not accurate to say that it's the biggest cut in history when you're going back to just pre-pandemic spending levels. I mean, because of the lockdown, it made everything bigger. That's like saying, to me, it seems very, it's similar to saying that look at all these jobs we created, which are just like jobs that you restored from lockdown. It's very similar to that. Welcome back to the program. Dana Lash here with you. You can listen coast to coast, terrestrially. You can stream the radio program. You can watch the simulcast, Facebook, YouTube, Channel 347, DirecTV. One of my favorite people in Congress from Texas. Obviously, Congressman Chip Roy joins us. He's got the best background of anybody that we've ever had, I have to say, from Congress. And I love that he was running down the hallway from the floor, and then he didn't know if he's going to have time to make it. And he grabbed somebody's chair or stool, and he just sat right down in the middle of the hallway. And then he had time to get to his office. It was great. I can tell you're crabby, though. I can tell you're mad from all this. Welcome to the show.
Well, we're running around, Dana. Great to be on the show, but we're just trying to, just frankly, just keep Republicans honest. And look, I love my Republican colleagues. I'm happy to work with them and anybody up here, Democrats, Republicans, but we should be honest with the American people. And there's a whole lot of cheerleading going on. You know, one way I put it earlier is if I'm putting this in the light most favorable for my Republican colleague, we are basically claiming that we're hitting a grand slam, biggest tax cut in history and all these wonderful things, when at best, it's basically a sacrifice bunt in the ninth inning to move the guy from first to second with one out in the ninth and you're down 10 runs. Mm. But I don't even think it's that good. Frankly, I think we got taken. For example, Greg Kassar, a progressive liberal from Austin, Texas, he said, we came out looking like a total fool after talks with Biden. Jamal Bowman has said the same thing, that we got our butts kicked. Look, the fact is, this is a $4 trillion debt increase. That's what it is. And I'm happy to debate my colleagues anywhere they want to go. Prove to me that it's not better, basically, effectively, a spending freeze for 2 years in exchange for a $4 trillion debt increase. Then they say, oh, we got work requirements. But the work requirements, basically, we found out yesterday, means there's going to be more people on the SNAP roll, right? They said, oh, we got NEPA reform. Well, I'm not sure the NEPA reforms are that good based on what the former Deputy Secretary of Energy told me under Perry, but all it does is grease the skids for more energy projects. I could keep going down the list, but I don't think we got a great deal.
And I know, too, talking with Congressman Chip Roy from the Republic of Texas, I was looking also, this was something I think that Mike Lee had said, is that within the bill, I think it's what, Section 265, it kind of renders meaningless the bill's much touted regulatory reforms as well.
Correct. So Mike Lee has been a champion, as has Rand Paul, of the RAIMS Act. CAMAC carries it here in the House. It would be a great bill. It would say that if a regulation would have an economic impact of about $100 million, Congress would have to approve it. Well, my colleagues, respectfully, who cut the deal, they cut a deal for what they call administrative paygo. Well, what that means is, and it was a Trump-era policy that my friend Russ Vogt, former director of the Office of Management and Budget, who worked for Trump, what they put in place under Trump. But it requires an OMB that will enforce it. In the text of the law, it's waivable. Literally what they said, we will waive this to advance Biden policies. Of course they will. It's ridiculous that they count this as a win. It's not.
Yeah, not a win at all. And I understand, because I've seen so much spin for this, and I know that sometimes a lot of people, people are busy, and I think government has gotten too big, and for a reason, to keep people from being able to simply track what's happening, with their tax dollars federally. I get it that it is a negotiation on budgetary items that have previously been passed by Congress, and that it's a debt ceiling negotiation, not a budget negotiation. However, that doesn't mean that you still can't make demands and have concessions and make reductions, correct?
Correct. And in fact, the debt ceiling is your maximum point of leverage.
Right.
And mind you now, we're only going to have 2 or 3 points of leverage since Republicans took the House last November. One was in December, which Senate Republicans teamed with Democrats to stick it to America and to us. And they passed a $1.7 trillion omnibus bill, lifting spending massively, 10% for defense, 7% for non-defense. Huge loss. We lost all of our leverage on the border. Now you fast forward to the debt ceiling. Now we have leverage again. We had them in the corner because we were united. We passed the Limit, Save, Grow Act, which was pretty awesome. Yes, it increased the debt $1.5 trillion, but it had massive policy changes and serious spending cuts. Now we only really have one more leverage point. Why? Because we're passing this bill, which Democrats basically love. We're going to then take away that leverage until January 1st, 2025 for $4 trillion. And now the only leverage we have remaining are the spending bills in September and next year's spending bills. And that's kind of it. it. The NDAA, a couple of things that are must pass. We're losing our leverage. And guess what? I'm trying to find the real wins for the country. How are we going to claw back the DEI and all the woke stuff? How are we going to truly, you know, actually bend the curve down instead of just softening the spending curve and then say it's somehow, you know, the most historic cuts in history?
Yeah.
Look, if you save a few bucks, you know, a small percentage of a massive amount of spending, because we're now spending $6 trillion a year post-COVID, yeah, it might be the most cuts in history because now we're spending so much damn money.
True. That's doing the math. That's why I'm like, I don't really think that's completely genuine to say it like that. Talking with Congressman Chip Roy,
correct.
The IRS agents, the way that I read this, that's just a year reprieve. So we would be kicking the can down the road literally right into the next election cycle. That seems like a win for Democrats.
I mean, I'm trying to find pieces of this bill that aren't predominantly wins for Democrats. They keep their Green New Deal agenda in place. The spending is literally a freeze. The IRS expansion stays almost entirely in place. The RAINS Act is not implemented. Just go down the list. And on the IRS question, what my colleagues will say who cut the deal is that they got $1.4 billion removed from this year's ability to expand the IRS. Now, keep in mind, their regular budget is about $8 or $9 billion a year. They're going to continue to have that unless we take it away in appropriations, which technically we could. And they're going to leave the rest of the $78.6 billion in place. Now, they'll say, don't worry, we'll go after it again in the future. Remember, they made it our number one priority to defund the IRS expansion. We passed that bill out of the gate in January, but it does no good to pass a bill and then walk away from it when you actually have the leverage point to force its inclusion. Same thing, by the way, for the student loans. We passed a bill last week to get rid of the student loans because we said, oh, the president doesn't have that power. It's unconstitutional. It's unlawful. But when it came to the actual decision time, the you-know-what cutting time, we allowed them to pull the student loan repeal out. Why would we do that? We have a duty to defend the Constitution. We shouldn't have let them walk away from taking the student loan cancellation out.
And you mentioned, too, Congressman, the appropriations process. But doesn't this kind of kill? I think you mentioned this, and I think there were a couple of other lawmakers who mentioned that it kind of takes away your leverage for that.
It certainly makes the debate in the fall much more difficult because we capitulated and cut a deal with Democrats rather than holding the line that we could say was truly something that represents the entirety of the Republican conference and force a few Dems to join us to get it done. Instead, it was a deal cut with Dems. That does not bode well heading into appropriations. And oh, by the way, with all due respect to those who keep touting this 1% automatic CR at the end of the year, there's nothing automatic about it. It is literally just an adjustment to a cap for January 1, which, by the way, will absolutely get voted out of existence when we get to the end of the year and there's a big omnibus bill and all of the defense hawks and everybody in this town say, hey, we got to pass this bill right before Christmas. And then we will be forced with the same question we had yesterday in the Rules Committee. Will three Republicans stand up and say no to a bad rule? Two of us did. The question will be this fall, when we get a bad bill in the Rules Committee, will three of us block it? Are there spending caps? Yeah. There are 2 years of spending caps, which basically is why I call it a spending freeze. Because right. It's about 2 years of spending caps. You started a $12 billion cut, and then it goes up 1%. And so you basically have a spending freeze for 2 years. Now, by the way, there's one other piece to that. The COVID money, which was rescinded... There was $28 billion. $6 billion was actually rescinded. The other $22 billion was moved into an account at the Department of Commerce to sit in there that isn't against the cap. It's just sitting there to be used as play money. Why? Because everybody in this town is pre-wired to save and be able to find a way to spend money. So they want to have some money there to go backfill the non-defense spending. That's all part of the game. Same thing with the IRS, by the way. I'm told, hey, Chip, don't worry. We're going to go get $10 billion a year out of the IRS. Okay, well, you're promising me you're going to do that in appropriations. Let me take you at your word. But what you're promising me is you're going to go get $10 billion out of IRS and go move it over to non-defense in order to backfill the spending cuts to the other bureaucrat. This town is on autopilot. We're trying to stop it. And unfortunately, this deal keeps it on autopilot.
Last question for you. I know you're super busy, and we appreciate your time today. I see people like, you know, Marjorie Taylor Greene saying that she's leaning. Yes. I know Congressman Thomas Massie, very good friend of ours. I know he's a good friend of yours, too. I think he's got some different motivations. He was talking about, you know, getting it off the floor and having everybody yell about it, or getting it to the floor and having everybody yell about it. And we've reached out to him, and I think he's going to come on. He's working with his schedule, sure, because I'm very interested in hearing kind of his the machinations on that. But what is your take? I mean, there are a couple people I'm a little surprised about. I mean, Massey always has, I think, a secret hand. But there are a couple people I'm a little surprised at, and I'm just wondering, is it, you know, are they trying to curry favor with leadership? Like, what's going on?
Well, look, Thomas is one of my best friends here in Washington, and I always want to keep it that way.
Yes.
And so it's hard when you disagree with your friends, kind of like when you have some disagreements. I mean, I know you and Chris, you guys never, you know, have disagreements in your house.
Oh,
you
never, guys, you know, ever. Right. I'm always right, you know, is why. Yeah. You know.
Exactly. Well, I know it. Hey, he's a smart man, right? He's always right. But look, Thomas and I disagree on this. You'll have to ask Thomas. I will only say where I think there's some strong disagreement is that this 1% deal at the end of the year will do any good. It only does good if we're willing to stand up and stop a rule that will inevitably be jammed through because we have the same pressures that were brought to bear this week. So in other words, you got to just play with the card in front of you. Everybody likes to play chess. Oh, it's, you know, 3D chess and all these things. Look, man, Congress is actually kind of checkers. You just got to be willing to hold the line. Like, you just got to be willing to say, look, man, no. Like, don't overcomplicate this crap, right? You don't need a, you know, crazy method to actually achieve what you need to do when you just stand up. So, again, I love Thomas. Talk to him about it.
Yeah, it'll be good conversation. Congressman Chip Roy, we appreciate you. Appreciate you breaking it down for everybody as well. I mean, you got a way of doing it that cuts through all the BS, so we appreciate that. Thanks for joining us today.
It gets me in trouble sometimes, but thanks, Dan.
There you go. No, it's great. We appreciate it. Congressman Chip Roy from the Republic of Texas, and we'll make sure that we have some good information on that, especially with the COVID money and just relocating it to where it doesn't count against. That's nuts. That's some shenanigans. Yeah. But if you sell a lawnmower and you get paid on Venmo, IRS is going to come knocking on your door. Where's the little hidey, the shady spot we can move our money in and it doesn't count? Where's that at? Oh, that just makes me mad. I want to throw something.
It's his life mission to make bad decisions. It's time for Florida Man.
A Florida man dressed in a cat costume was arrested after stabbing his roommate in the neck. Actual thing. Police were called to a home in Gainesville last week after a man called 911 to report he had been stabbed in the neck. In a video that was on Facebook, Captain Chris Sims said that two deputies forced their way inside of a home where the stabbing victim lay on the floor, bleeding. The suspect was still inside that residence and potentially armed. The body cam footage, according to Tampa Free Press, says that shows officers at the doorway talking to the victim, instructing him to walk out of the house. And then they called out the suspect, identified as Omar Gutierrez, to come out with his hands in the air. So Gutierrez comes out, his arms raised, and he's wearing a gray and white cat onesie. It's a cat costume. I've seen other reports say it was pajamas. That ain't pajamas. He's legit in like a cat costume. The 32-year-old was charged with one count of attempted murder. He's held on $1 million bond. That's something else. Seaweed, massive amounts of it washing ashore in Florida. It contains flesh-eating bacteria that can cause leaky gut syndrome. It's called sargassum. The seaweed blankets the beaches with thick brown algae, emitting a strong odor as it decomposes. I've read this happening before in certain parts. It happens, you know, on a lot of shorelines. But they say the pathogens, blah, 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 microplastics, warm ocean water, blah, 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 blah. But, you know, just be careful and don't play in it. Don't be eating it. Don't be rolling around in it. But the leaky gut thing is kind of terrifying. It's like they say that the worst part of it, the red algae, has been on Florida's southwest coast. And so it's like near Naples and like it's like basically south of St. Petersburg, Florida is where it looks like that's the most where it happens. But they say that you can have like some coughing, some wheezing, things like that for asthmatics. It can, you know, you can have some respiratory issues. Don't be playing in it. They do a lot to try to, you know, get rid of it. Something that it's a normal thing that happens annually, but the leaky gut thing, it's like I don't like the name of it. That sounds like a bad metal band name. I mean, if I'm being honest, let's see. I've got a couple. How much time do I have? Do I have time for two stories or one?
Only one.
Okay, let's end with this. This is a ghost story I was telling you about. Florida man claims he broke into a house to hide from a ghost. Florida man Andrew George is in jail. He broke into a home because he said a ghost was chasing him. Daytona Beach police say George was booked last week for two counts of burglary. According to his arrest report, they were called to this Daytona Beach historic home for a shooting, but it was a burglary. When they arrived, they found a man identified as George laying on his back on the front steps, covered in blood, crying. After they spoke with him, they said that the people there heard someone try to break in. They engaged, etc. But he said that he ran to the house because the ghosts were chasing him. And he had been fighting the ghosts in the street. Well, apparently, he also admitted to taking Molly, a.k.a. ecstasy.
There it is.
And that's probably what happened.
There it is.
I'm just going to say, you know there's Ring doorbell footage somewhere of him fighting with himself in the street. Just saying. Stick with us, because we have a whole other hour on the way back after this.
We only got to look at 11% of the budget to find these cuts. We have to look at the entire budget. The Congress has done this before.
Why didn't you see the whole budget?
Because the president walled off all the others. The majority driver of the budget is mandatory spending. It's Medicare, Social Security, interest on the debt. So you only have 11% to look at this budget.
So I'm not, then what are we voting on it? It's a million-dollar question. Why are we voting on it then? Welcome back to the program. Dana Lash here with you. Top of this third hour this Wednesday. I have a bunch of things I want to get into. We're going to be talking about the whole situation with Attorney General Ken Paxton out of Texas. It's a very, because they voted to impeach him. He's having a fight with some of the moderate Republicans. It's a very interesting story. And we're going to talk with Representative Matt Schaefer about that coming up. And I have some 2024 stuff, and I have some woke things to get into, but I came across this piece on break. This is a really good piece. It's intentionally provocative. And I'm going to read some of it to you. And I'm going to put it in your newsletter because I think it's a good piece. Rarely do I tell you to read something, but I come across things from time to time that I'm like, yeah, I think this is required reading for you tonight. Corina Benton is the author of this piece. It's over at Spectator. The headline is, "To Win the Culture War, We Need Fewer Conservatives and More Counter-Revolutionists." Very intentionally provocative. She writes, and I'll get that it's worth it. She writes, "Of all the calamities currently turning this country on its head, the most demoralizing is the catastrophic failure of 100 years of conservatism." Now, I will add a quick caveat. I don't think it's failed because it's never been fully implemented. And that is true. It's always, you've never had pure capitalism. It's been crony capitalism. There's a number of things that there's caveats to this. So that's where I disagree. But I do think that this is correct. Conservatives are good at piecing together the collapse of the southern border, the weaponization of the Department of Justice, and the en masse sexual grooming and mutilation of children, as well as pointing the finger at Marxist left and radical policies. They are less interested in the how we get here, how we got here debate. Without this, the prospects of resuscitating a republic on life support are negligible. We are in the throes of an unprecedented winner-takes-all revolution against Western civilization. And since the objective of worldwide communism, cunningly rebranded in recent decades as globalism, was always the absolute full communization of the United States, this is no surprise. The real shock for many on the right is that the conservative movement, which I don't think it's incapable of fighting, but it is having a difficult time crushing this rebellion, I would say. She gets into Whitaker Chambers, and before breaking with the Communist Party over 80 years ago, the former Time magazine editor worked for a Soviet intel network in the U.S., and in 48, he blew the lid off the communist infiltrated executive branch in jaw-dropping testimony before the House Un-American Activities Committee. His evidence, notably the famous Pumpkin Papers, which exposed the senior department official Alger Hiss, was so damning that committee member Representative Richard Nixon, upon learning of the stashed files, arranged to be picked up at sea by the Coast Guard while en route to Panama for a long-awaited vacation with his wife, so he could race back to Washington and review the bombshell contents. A decade earlier, Chambers had met with General Walter Kravitsky, a former senior Soviet military intel officer and fellow commie. They shared their perspectives on communism, agreed the forces of history in the postmodern era can be grasped as only the interaction of revolution and counter-revolution. And he said that there was no middle ground. The problem, as Chambers saw it, is that counter-revolution has little to do with conservatism. The conservative seeks first to conserve what he is and what he has. He wants to be left alone and is largely uninterested in self-sacrifice. I'm not talking military. This is the head in the sand strategy. If I ignore it long enough, it'll probably go away. And it is passive. And it's been further diluted through malfeasance with the my way, your way, anyway, classical liberals whose lack of a fixed moral compass is the ideological loophole that communists have exploited to gain a foothold in this country in the first place. The product of this union is the line in the sand strategy. Don't force me to abandon my side and I'll leave you alone on yours. Both stratagems are futile against the violent and inexorable tides of communism. If he adopts the former, the conservative will be engulfed in the deluge. If he tries the latter, his position will be erased and redrawn to the point that he no longer recalls where he started, she writes. These dynamics are playing out in every day, in every aspect of today's culture war. Piece from The Spectator. The conservative derides his opponents as woke progressives and social justice warriors. The counter-revolutionist recognizes that they're communists. The conservative will accept amnesty for illegal aliens. No, that's a Republican, not a conservative. The counter-revolutionist demands deportation along with liability for every public office holder, human trafficker, and nonprofit organization who has aided and abetted the breaking of federal law. The conservative seeks to wrest the levers of power from a hostile administrative state. The counter-revolutionist wants to starve the beast by permanently defunding it. The conservative genteelly defends himself against accusations of book banning. The counter-revolutionists used existing criminal codes to go after pedophile teachers, librarians, and administrators who knowingly distribute pornographic content to minors. And the conservative can't keep track of companies they're supposed to boycott. The counter-revolutionist has the names etched in their brain. They'll happily forego slave labor merch from misogynistic brands like Nike and disposable junk designed by Satanists for groomer retailers like Target. The conservative won't let politics get in the way of sports. The counter-revolutionists won't offend God and scandalize his children by supporting leagues like the NHL and MLB. The conservative wants school choice and control of school boards. And the counter-revolutionist wants to dismantle the Department of Education and rip federal funding from a public education system so decayed by anti-American, anti-family, anti-Christian, and anti-intellectual rot that it would be better to let the whole damn vessel sink and let individual states salvage what they will. Crucially, the conservative understands that this is an attack on history, culture, tradition, and biblical values. The counter-revolutionist knows it's fundamentally a revolt against God. And as Whitaker Chambers explained, communism is not simply a vicious conspiracy hatched by wicked men. It's not just about Marx and Lenin and materialism and collectivism and subversion and control of the masses. Although it is all of these things, at its root, it is a vision of man without God. Hence, she writes, the counter-revolutionist adopts, as Chambers did, the position that this great secular faith of the postmodern age is wrong. And the Christian faith of the ages is right. If you dance around this basic premise, you wind up with Republican governors who think banning child mutilation procedures amounts to, quote, vast government overreach, as some have. And brand name conservatives who fret that boycotting Bud Light over its cynical mockery of women would destroy an iconic American company. You get renowned intellectuals who argue that pornography is acceptable and writers who think jokes about sodomizing women make for a witty conservative commentary. And you end up with America's most pro-life president quibbling over six-week abortion bans. This might impress a handful of libertarians here and appease a smattering of neurotic suburban women there, but it won't quell a demonic revolutionary spirit that seeks nothing less than the exile of the God-man Jesus Christ and enslavement of mankind. This force can only be countered by a level of discernment, faith, courage, and self-sacrifice every bit as zealous as that of the opponents. Now, I disagree where Benton writes that conservatism has outlived its usefulness because conservatism is the soul of the counter-revolutionist, in my opinion. Because without that building block, you would not get from that point to the next. However, I do think that you have a lot of conservatism that is tied up with a lot of the myopic and apathetic generic brand of Republican partyism. And ultimately, that's how you get the crony capitalism. That's how you get, instead of just deconstructing the IRS, you get tax credits. Instead of deconstructing the NEA and the Department of Education, you get, well, let's have some school choice and vouchers. That's all great, but that's not the real problem solved. It is an aid to help treat and deal with the problem. But I do think that there are two different things. It's not just about, and I do appreciate most out of all of this, the point in this, I'm reading an article by Karina Benton from Spectator. I do like the passive resistance of the conservative movement has been further diluted with the my way, your way, anyway, classical liberals, whose lack of a fixed moral compass is the ideological loophole communists exploited to gain a foothold in this country in the first place. That is right. A lot of people adopt libertarian thinking because they're scared. I'm not saying all, and there are going to be some out there who are so stupid and don't want to actually discuss the deeper side of that. They want to act as though it's a universal statement about all libertarians because that's easier to argue. It's a Mott Bailey practice. But there are a lot of people that say, oh, well, I'm more libertarian on this because they're scared as hell. They're not confident enough to articulate and hold strong courageously to a viewpoint, a fixed point on a number of issues. The my way, your way, anyway, classical liberals. There are certain things that can't just be left alone without the expectation of them not bothering. I mean, if you leave alone, they will come back on you. And that's, I think, that is the heart of what is, that is the problem of a big tent on the right, because you have to deal with that. But what's more, I think a lot of people on the right have to have a very honest conversation with themselves. How serious are you? I love school choice. I like vouchers. That's great. Ultimately, I want to completely abolish the Department of Education. Because I don't think that it's fruitful to have a centrally controlled, one-size-fits-all educational process run by bureaucrats who are completely out of touch and not even in the areas that they're regulating for, or the areas which they are regulating. I want to deconstruct it. I don't believe in an IRS. I think it is bureaucratic sin. They try to assign virtue to theft by way of saying, well, it's law. I think some conservatives need to have that honest conversation. You have Republicans who are party, and they will strategize about party first. Conservatives look to conserve individual sovereignty and limit government power. And I think that counter-revolutionists, you have to be a conservative to be a counter-revolutionist. So I think that you can't have that, without conservatism. And conservatism, there are a lot of people, and I'll say it again, who think that history began the damn day they were born. And they don't realize what a lot of conservative fighters have done in the days that precede their political awakening. And there's been a lot of work to even get to the point where we're at now. And it's always work. It is work every day. It is work every week. It is work every month. It is work every year. And then you get a whole other group of people who also think that history began the day that they were born. And then you kind of have to start all over again. Thus is the nature of humanity in a political system such as ours. But it is a privilege and not a burden. And that's the other problem that a lot of people on the right have to deal with. Stop feeling so damn burdened by the privilege of freedom. Get your ass off of Twitter, get your ass off of Facebook, and get out in the streets and make it happen.
And now, all of the news you would probably miss. It's time for Dana's Quick Five.
So apparently more than a quarter of homeowners in the United States are house poor, spending more than 30% of their income on housing costs, according to a new study. Chamber of Commerce had a product research company use numbers from the Census Bureau. They analyzed monthly housing costs, median household income in the 170 most populated U.S. cities, and they found that 27% of all homeowners are cost burdened in its study. The highest, Miami, Los Angeles, and New York, where 4 in 10 homeowners in each city feel stretched beyond their means from housing bills alone. And housing costs are rising nationally. New Zealand. Air New Zealand is going to weigh passengers before they board the airplane. Great idea. I agree. New Zealand Civil Aviation Authority is asking that its national airline waive passengers departing on international flights from Auckland all the way through to July 2nd of this year. The program, which they call passenger weight surveys, to gather data on the weight load and distribution for planes. They say they weigh everything that goes in the aircraft. That's true. They said that they're making the data anonymous. Somebody's going to say that it's body shaming, but everyone says that until they're couched between two morbidly obese people whose stomachs go over the armrest and you can't even spread your legs apart because they're taking your area below the seat too. It's that bad. It's happened. I'm telling you. Too much caffeine can lead to sleep deprivation. What? It's a stupid study, and I'm not even going to spend time on it because this is ridiculous. Taylor Swift fans say they're getting amnesia at her concerts. It's the overwhelming wave of emotions that cause people to forget it all. Some people apparently have been wearing diapers so they don't miss a moment. That's disgusting. That's nasty. Stop being nasty. Ugh. But they said that, you're talking about, some of the women they spoke to are in their mid to late 20s. What in the world is wrong with you? They're like, it's overload. The emotional overload makes it harder to form memories. I've never been emotionally overloaded by an entertainment act or a person that wasn't like my child being born, right? And even then, I was still, what in the world? I don't understand some of this stuff. And then groundbreaking cancer treatment from Israel has a 90% success rate. One of their medical centers has a 90% success rate at bringing multiple myeloma into remission. It's a cancer treatment that, they're still doing studies, super successful. Representative Matt Schaefer next.
Whether you just want to stay informed or just hear her vent about all the ridiculousness in the world, make sure to download the Dana Show podcast wherever you get your podcasts.
Do you see how it could appear or it could be perceived by anyone in the building or outside the building when they're Democrats? Could you see how it could appear that it's politically motivated investigation?
No,
on their behalf.
I could also see that multiple of those persons that we hired to work for us also worked in the U.S. Attorney's Office for a Republican appointee from a Republican president. So, no, I do not see that appearance.
I believe perception is truth to the person that perceives. So if someone perceives something, it's truth to them.
That second lawmaker speaking gets all his strength from his mustache. We just played a video there. That was Texas Representative Tony Tenderholt asking the chairman of the General Investigating Committee about this impeachment of Texas's Attorney General Ken Paxton. Now, you might think, well, this is kind of a Texas issue. And yes, we have a lot of affiliates around the Republic of Texas, and we also have a lot of affiliates across the country. But I think that this issue is starting to grow into a national marker, I think is a good way to put it. Because Paxton is pretty popular across Texas. I mean, you would have to be when you start in 2015 and there's this like legal cloud that is around you and you keep winning re-election in spite of a lot of other, the things that have been reported. And you are a fighter for a lot of, conservative, a lot of the conservative agenda. And then you have something like this happens. And whether or not it was retaliatory because of what was done with Speaker Dade Phelan. And for those of you who don't know about Dade Phelan, I know y'all have seen the video of the guy who looks like he's drunk speaking on the floor of the House, because that was him. That went everywhere. There's a lot to unpack here. And I thought one of the best explainers on this came from Texas Representative Matt Schaefer, who had said, and I quote, "I publicly opposed Ken Paxton's reelection in the Republican primary, and I called out his very serious and moral, legal and legal failings. But if it is right to impeach Ken Paxton, it is being done in the wrong way. Barring a drastic change in the nature of the House proceedings on impeachment, I will be voting no." He adds he doesn't have confidence in the procedure. He also adds that apparently members of the full House had no direct access to witnesses, supporting documents. They have not had any time to prepare or even understand the matters in question. And nobody even knows whether or not any of these people apparently gave their testimony under oath. There's a lot of questions here. Texas Representative Matt Schaefer joins us via Skype now. Good to see you. Thank you so much for giving us some of your time today. So just to be clear, it sounds like you have never been given access to anything regarding this case or these cases, but yet you're supposed to make a determination based on like third party information.
That's correct, Dana. Not only were we not allowed to have access to the witnesses, we did not have access to the investigators. All we heard was an audio or read the transcript of the investigators talking to the five members of the committee. But during the impeachment proceedings on the House floor, I confirmed that none of the witnesses were ever put under oath. And the members of the House General Investigations Committee did not interview the witnesses as part of their process. And so to my knowledge, as part of the formal impeachment process, no member of the legislature was able to question witnesses. Now, there were some members who had individual knowledge of what happened with certain witnesses because of the relationships outside the chamber. Now, when you look at the procedure that was conducted in order to impeach Ken Paxton and essentially overturn an election, it was a sham. This was not the way it should have been done.
Wow. We're talking with Texas Representative Matt Schaefer on this impeachment of Texas Attorney General Ken Paxton. So you're, and it, I mean, it makes sense. Your objection to this is the sham way that it's being done, which is, it's weird because there's so, I just remember when we moved here in 2013. And I remember seeing all this stuff about Ken Paxton and all of these reports and, you know, the accusations about securities and all this stuff. And the girl, I mean, there was a lot of stuff out there. The guy kept winning re-election, you know, election after election. He was winning voters. He was out there in the ring fighting. He was pushing back on voter fraud, on mail-in ballots, you know, that don't have signatures and you can't match the dates. I mean, he's pushing back on all the right things. And it seems as though voters were aware of all of this because they saw the same stuff that I did. So aren't voters kind of the check and balance on this?
They should be. And if you were going to go through the constitutional process of impeachment to overturn that decision that those voters made, then you better have a really good process. If you're going to end up with an outcome that folks back home are wondering what the heck happened, this really stinks. You better be able to go to them and say, hey, we heard the testimony. We talked to the investigators. We saw the evidence, and this was a just outcome. Dana, I can't do that. If I go stand in front of the people of East Texas and they ask me about this, I'm going to have to tell them that this process was a sham. And maybe there would have been a different outcome if we'd have gone through a really good procedure, but we don't know. And this was done in a hurried manner. The House General Investigations Committee operated for weeks outside the knowledge of rank and file members. And then when they did make their proceedings public, it happened so quickly. And they dropped this information on us. And this happened over the Memorial Day weekend. I mean, we literally had like 36 to 48 hours to process this information. We had little to no time to go back and look at the historical precedents of similar proceedings that had been done in Texas history. And many of the safeguards that you would hope would be in place for rule of law and due process simply were not conducted here. And I worry that trust has been seriously eroded. And we're living in a time where Americans are already skeptical of institutions. Mm-hmm. We don't need that kind of perception when it comes to how we conduct business at the highest levels of government in Texas.
And it seems, too, we're talking to Texas Representative Matt Schaefer, that if there's evidence here that Democrats or Republicans or the people who are pushing the suspension, the impeachment and the investigation, they kind of undermined their cause because, you know, if they're demanding that you all make a determination based on evidence that has been withheld from you, I mean, you usually only get one shot at this in the court of public opinion, and it seems like they blew it.
They did, and they told us, well, go read the transcript, go listen to the audio. Well, the audio was a conversation between five House members and investigators who had been hired by them. So we have hearsay there, but it's hearsay upon hearsay because the investigators were relaying conversations they had with witnesses And the witnesses were relaying conversations they had with third people. So it was hearsay within hearsay within hearsay. And so we were not able to cross-examine anyone. And none of those witnesses were placed under oath.
Wow. Now, from what I I've read, First Assistant Attorney General Brent Webster is leading the office, and the governor can appoint an interim or leave the position open. Any idea as to what's going to happen with that?
Governor Abbott does have the ability to put someone into that office to carry out the duties while Ken Paxton is suspended. I don't know what he's going to do. And Dana, it's going to be very interesting to see what the Senate does.
Because his wife is a state senator.
His wife is a state senator. But more importantly, folks back home are very concerned about the process that's being conducted here. And it just doesn't smell right. And, you know, I think sometimes there's this condescending attitude towards folks back home. Like, well, they just don't have all the information that we had. Or, you know, they just don't understand the rules of the House or how this was conducted. Let me tell you, folks. Folks get it. They smell that something was not done the right way. Now, I think folks back home know that Ken Paxton is not a Boy Scout. In fact, they know there's a lot going on there. And I've called out his moral and ethical failings. And I believe that he's dealt in some really dirty business. I believe that. But I had a constitutional obligation as a state representative to look at evidence and to not proceed without having evidence brought before the House, not evidence outsourced to people I've never met and never talked to. Hmm. That's not my constitutional duty.
No. Do you think, last question for you, do you think that, because everyone people keep saying that it's a witch hunt, which I think you kind of have to look at as to the nature of the accusations and the investigations and the charges that have been brought forward. But as for the process, it does seem, because it seems so shoddy, that it is really politically motivated. And it doesn't seem like it's just Democrats involved in it either. I know there's a lot of animosity between a lot of conservatives and, you know, the majority leader, the House Speaker there in Austin, Dade Phelan, and some others. Is that contributing to this as well?
It is. And the perception folks have back home, the optics, how it looks, it should have been done in a way that gave them confidence, and it just didn't. It eroded confidence. And if you're going to impeach a statewide officer and have the effect of overturning an election, then you better have an unimpeachable process.
There you go, right there. I think those are wise words. Texas Representative Matt Schaefer, appreciate you. Thank you so much for your reasoned take on this. I think it's much needed. Thanks for your time.
Thank you, Dana.
Of course. And that we'll make sure. I think I sent the link to his tweet out. I'm trying to remember in the email prep newsletter. But he's right. I mean, there's a lot there in the accusations and the charges that were previously leveled at him with regards to, you know, reporting, you know, some of the cases like the securities exchanges, all that bribery, abuse of office. There's been all kinds of stuff leveled at him. And this has been going on since 2015, and he keeps winning. Voters keep voting for him. I mean, he goes out there and he fights. And I think, you know, there's been the take that he fights so hard because it keeps the heat off him for all this other stuff. Maybe that's true. I haven't seen any of this, but you know what I do expect? I do expect that the people who are voting on impeachment to have seen what I haven't seen. And when they have been, I mean, you're telling me they're listening to a group of lawmakers, many of whom are Democrats, ask very specific questions of these investigators, and the amount of, insight into this is based on their answers alone, to the questions that have been specifically asked, and they don't have any other participation or access or insight into it. I expect those lawmakers, as Representative Schaefer was saying, I expect them to have access to this information. And when they don't, like I said, you get one shot in the court of public opinion. You know, there's the saying that goes, you know, go for the king, you best not miss. You get one shot in the court of public opinion. And if they really did have a serious, legitimate concern about impropriety, you know, regardless the weight or of the evidence, I mean, to go about it like this completely undermines their cause. and they have nobody to blame but themselves. They can get mad at conservatives. They can get mad at, you know, Paxton or anybody else, but they would have nobody to blame but themselves because they got the cart up ahead of the horse. They had more zeal than they had sense, and they decided to go about it this way. I mean, you can't tell me that with all those brains down there in Austin, this is the best they could come up with to approach it in this manner. I mean, what a fecal show. That is shameful. That's, I mean, it's ridiculous. This is like JV stuff for the love. And I, you know, maybe there's something to it. Like I said, this is, you know, getting in on that story and all those accusations. I have friends that are split right down the middle, and they say these are serious accusations. Others say that it's a witch hunt. But one thing that they all agree on is that the way that it's been approached is a sham. Now, I don't know, the Senate's a little more conservative, so they actually are the ones who get to make the determination on this. I don't know if his wife is going to recuse herself or not. They have to have a 2/3 threshold for his removal. And the Senate is, you know, more conservative, and that's where they're going to, it's where they have the trial. His wife, Angela Paxton, she's, like I said, state senator. So I don't know how, I mean, we'll see. I don't know how that's going to go, but it's going to be interesting.
Catch the Dana Show noon to 3 p.m. Eastern on DirecTV Channel 347.
The compromise gives you, as the OMB director, complete waiver authority over administrative paygo.
She looks so unimpressed.
If you deem it necessary for program delivery. I'm wondering, if the bill as written becomes law, how frequently do you anticipate using that waiver authority?
Look, it's impossible to know the frequency, but I do know we negotiated all of this in good faith. We will follow the processes laid out in the law on paygo. And if that waiver is deemed necessary to make sure President Biden's agenda is carried forward, we're going to use that authority.
What kind of answer is that?
Authoritarian?
Yeah, that's Shalonda Young, one of his econ, his budget directors. And she was asked, well, how frequently do you anticipate using PAYGO? You know what I have to say? Can I just interject? She seems really stern, and she has RBF. So if you don't know what that is, I have it. It's called resting bitch face. And you have to look expressive all the time. Otherwise, you look like you're mean and hateful. She has RBF. So she just seems like real, you know. I kind of like her better than KJP just from that.
First 5 years I worked with you, I thought you were just always mad at me.
Yeah, I have that expression. My mom looks like that eagle puppet from the Muppets.
Took me years to get over it.
Yeah, I mean, it's just, I don't know how it is.
I'm better now. Thank you.
Are you okay? Yeah. Over there with your juice boxes. Kane brought juice for him and Juan, so they're over here.
It does again. I just don't want Juan have to go through.
They're juice box buddies.
I don't want Juan to have to go through what I've gone through.
Kane comes in here with like 3 to 4 juices per day. And he gave Juan a liver exploding thing.
That is not what I gave him at all. You're really eating into my Today in Stupidity.
Sorry, liver cleanser. Anyway, we'll talk more about it tomorrow. Take your time to get your Today in Stupidity.
It's KJP.
Thank you. What is President Biden's top domestic priority?
Well, we've always been very clear that his economic policy isn't something that's important.
Listen to this,
especially
part.
When he walked into this administration, the economy was on its head because of the COVID response that was not existing with the last administration.
How was the COVID thing not existing in the last administration? Stop.
None of this makes sense.
Stupid.
None of this makes sense. There you go. Folks, that does it for us today. Make sure you sign up for Chapter and Verse over at Substack. I'll be back with you tomorrow.